Welcome, everybody, and thank you, Jeff, and thank you, Anna, and thank you, David. I'm really delighted to be able to present my findings at CEDA today, and it's really wonderful to see the interest shown. I'd like to thank the participating organisations for their general support, firstly. It really is a reflection of the value that these organisations place on leadership research and the issue of women in management. I'd certainly like to thank the 115 men and women who generously offered their time, thoughts and feelings about this very challenging and somewhat contested area. It's certainly made for the rich data set that underpins the report. And thank you to members of the reference group, and Jeff named some of them and they're in the report, for their guidance and comment. And special thanks goes to Dr. Katie Spirit, from the NAB, from Professor Amanda Sinclair from the Melbourne Business School, and to Jeff for their meticulous reading of the draft and the valuable suggestions which greatly enhanced the final document. And thank you, CEDA, for your support in hosting this event today and providing once again a forum where leadership research can be explored and debated. As a woman working in organisations for, dare I say it, over a quarter of a century, I have observed much change. The workplace is now a far more conducive place for women's participation than it was when I first started, and the fruits are reflected in a steadily rising female workforce participation rate. Yet sadly, though, some things have been slow to change. Women's progress into leadership positions has been sluggish. As Anna pointed out, statistical evidence indicates a parlous state with women underrepresented in leadership positions and their contributions undervalued relative to their male counterparts. The moral dimension to this pervasive inequality cannot be ignored. It flies in the face of values and principles which underpin our social order and which business supports and promulgates. Building a civil economy is fundamental to building a civil society. The economic case for widening the talent pool has been well established, and as Anna said, there was a war on global executive talent. Indeed, the shortage of talent is cited as a key restraining factor for continued growth in the Australian economy, or at least until recently. Yet, despite the market's hunger for high-level talent, the market is failing when it comes to female executives. Intervention is required. If past trends are any indication of the future, this is not a transitory phenomenon that will reverse once a generation of appropriately qualified women become better positioned for promotion. Some 15 years ago, David Carpen presented his findings highlighting the lack of diversity in Australian business culture. Amanda Sinclair's study of Trials of the Top around the same time also drew attention to this very issue. 15 years down the track, despite entering an era of hyperchange, some things have not changed, or certainly not changed enough. Women are not moving through organisational ranks. Many are stalling at the middle management level. Barriers to female entry exist. While these barriers are not overt and explicit, they are nevertheless more insidious because they are subtle, often unconscious, and therefore more difficult to unearth and to address, and yet so very powerful in their capacity to undermine female confidence, female experience and female retention. The leadership challenge explores the basis for these less visible phenomena. John McFarlane, former CEO of the ANZ Bank, advocated the need for an honest conversation about gender issues in organisations as a way of moving forward. I found this approach most valuable in engaging participants to explore the elephant in the room, the paucity of female leadership at executive level. The series Sex in the City has enabled women to feel more liberated to dress like women at work and not look like they're copying men, says one female journalist. This newfound liberation, she contends, has not extended to giving women greater financial power in the workplace. Indeed, there has been slippage, with pay differentials between women and men increasing. Her thesis is that women have been derailed. They've taken their eye off the ball by discarding the power suit. She says, and I quote, "The male wardrobe sends subtle signals. A grey suit suggests hidden power, and French cuffs rule a Wall Street board." Her recommendation to women is to dress in a way that detracts attention from what lies below. Perhaps by donning, and I quote, "a bold necklace and powerful gold links, or a Barbara Bush set of pearls that could take the role of a man's necktie." If only women stopped behaving like women, all the problems for women at work would just go away and dissipate. So, and I think the point I'm making is that these entrenched cultural beliefs regarding gender roles in society are held by men and women alike. It is this mental economy that informs the reality of workplace dynamics. Business, and indeed society, is in the thrall of primitive archetypes that see masculinity connoting potency, safety, and security, while displays of femininity conjure up images of disturbance that need quashing. Leadership is a masculine enterprise aligned with male bodies, male discourse, and male behaviours. As one senior male executive in the study said to me, "There are three reasons which instilled confidence in me years ago. I'm male, I'm 6'2", and I'm prematurely grey." While this was said tongue-in-cheek, it acknowledged the reality of his experience. When he steps onto the podium, the room stops. He recognises that a physical male presence provides a certain gravitas in organisational settings, which he says is not the same for men, for women. For women do not have the stature or booming voice to connote a true leadership presence. Masculine traits and characteristics define the essence of leadership. Participants in the study described a contemporary business culture that is aggressive, competitive, and relentless, requiring in some cases a 24/7 commitment. A strong short-term profit orientation demands decisiveness and adeptness at hard skills. Capacity for rationality, numerical competency, and expedient decision-making is highly valued. And I quote a female manager, "The language of relevance is numbers. It's the language of success. If you don't report and speak that language, you are invisible or mute." While relational skills attributable to women, such as interpersonal communication and emotional intelligence, are increasingly recognised as adding value, they sit well below in the hierarchy of traits valued by business. And I quote a female manager, "I was told for many years that I'd never make senior management. They would say to me, 'You're too easy to get on with. You'll never get anywhere here. You're too affable.' They think I'm too soft." The privileging of rationality over emotionality, combined with gender stereotyping, sees a cultural setting where female intellect is undermined. The well-documented reluctance of senior men to place women at the numbers end of management reflects the perception of women as numerically weak and encourages a view of women as innately lacking business sense. And I quote two senior male managers, "If we were looking at intellect as they do when they talk about talent, the female manager," referring to her, "would probably not have been a talent. Or when you talk to female managers, it becomes a bit of a country club. And I want to have more robust conversation." While this belief system is highly irrational because it has no cogent evidence base, this stereotypical mindset is nevertheless powerful in placing women in support roles rather than giving women opportunities to thrive as leaders in their own right. Feminine traits are at best tolerated as ancillary and, at worst, repudiated as not being relevant to business at all. Emotion, for example, when mediated through a gender stereotypical prism, is regarded pejoratively. It is located with women and associated with a lack of control, says one male manager in the study. They'll use the time of the month to excuse tears. Oh, you wouldn't understand. They'll quite happily throw that into the mix. And another male manager. Women tend to be a lot more emotional than men, and dealing with their emotional breakdowns when they are troublesome or stressful, oh, I think some men would probably find it difficult to cope with that. Men and women struggle in this culture. Men who are viewed as too soft are also at risk of being ostracised. Indeed, men who display what are stereotypically referred to as feminine behaviours, such as sensitivity and vulnerability, expose themselves to accusations of being what Robert Desai refers to as ambiguous men. It's almost to the point where male executives, and this is, I quote a female manager, it's almost as if male executives who demonstrate a kinder, more concessional view are isolated because of that, or vilified as pansies or gay or whatever because they are just being more moderate. Yet, aggression in males is more likely to be tolerated and in some case rewarded when it produces results. The manager, and I quote a female manager, the manager is the biggest bully. He has got results by shouting and belittling people. And there are a number of quotes in the report referring to very aggressive behaviour in attempting to achieve results. At the extreme, the idealisation of competitive, individualistic and results-orientated models of leadership can lead to dysfunctional behaviours. For this breeds a hero mentality, a superhuman status that, while lionising incumbents, disconnects them from reality and, dare I say, has led to some of the high-risk, high-reward recklessness both here and overseas, where breaks on accountability are all but dissipated. The metaphor of Masters of the Universe, made famous by Tom Wolfe, or Michael Lewis's more lurid expression, which I won't say here, in Liar's Poker, to refer to the big deal-maker in Wall Street's culture of machismo, has resonances. We have not been immune from cultures that, while rewarding competition and cleverness, have also rewarded arrogance, contempt and cowboy antics. An ill wind blows when systems reward and encourage omnipotent behaviour, for with omnipotence comes greed, slack regulation, poor disclosure, excessive gearing and appalling risk management, and even, as we have recently seen in this can-do culture, a tragic death. And I'll quote a male manager. I'm never wrong, or perhaps I'm often wrong, but never uncertain. It's a masculine thing to do, not to acknowledge that you are wrong. It's not always conscious either. Attack is the most common form of defence. And then a female manager. There is zero tolerance for saying, I don't know the answer. And then another male manager, I thought this was an excellent quote. Perhaps the courage of creativity is required. Perhaps the courage of admission of failure, as opposed to the desire to be right. I think that allows you to be agile in an environment that requires you to be agile. The power of emotion in leadership is fundamental. It is the essence of vision setting and the glue that fosters partnership between leaders and followers, and indeed shareholders or stakeholders generally. It is part of being human and a reality of organisational life. Negative associations between women and emotion distort not only perceptions of female value, but they pervert the nature of leadership practice. For undermining one's capacity to show emotion undermines one's capacity for authentic leadership. For automatons are impotent. Women struggle to gain recognition and reward in the prevailing business environment. They are trapped between an impenetrable male paradigm and an unpalatable female stereotype. Their position as cultural outsiders from senior management can undermine their confidence and experience of working life. Highly talented women can be sidelined and excluded from leadership positions based on a poor perception of poor cultural fit. And I'll quote a senior male manager here. "When I employ someone, it's got to be someone I trust. That's why I might employ men. Blokes trust blokes. It's a point of reference. We are consciously connected. We've been on the same path, on the same journey. You're like me. You look like me. Our values are aligned. It's Darwinian. We move in packs, and that's why we survive." Women... There is an element, and this is another quote from a female senior manager, "There's an element of senior management that is male that has real difficulty with females. Sometimes in a meeting, you can see they are uncomfortable because they like being surrounded with like-minded people. You'll never get into the inner circle. Women are subjected to intense scrutiny that transcends a realistic assessment of performance. They are judged on appearance and communication style." As one senior woman said, "The thing that will get women noticed, certainly under this management structure, is reasonable appearance. When I realised that's what was happening, I was bitterly disappointed. But then I realised it wasn't really my problem. If that's what's going to make me visible, well, I'm smart enough to deserve to be there anyway." And a male, quote from a male, "I don't like women blatantly using their sex appeal to get on, but some do. But guys are human. They can fantasise romantically and sexually and can be more likely to be supportive to those they find attractive. The study finds evidence that women regard the culture as too difficult and either leave or choose not to seek promotion, as Anna described. Some try to fit in. They internalise the responsibility for their poor cultural fit and through personal adaptation and sacrifice try to be okay in the eyes of men. And as one woman says, "I'm usually the only woman in the room. I'm conscious of trying to blend in rather than stand out. You don't want to draw attention to yourself. You tend to think twice before you say anything. If you are in an all-male environment, you hold back and express opinion offline." A high level of adaptation and compromise not only interferes with women's performance potential, but rarely proves a successful strategy. Adopting hard and aggressive demeanours, talking sport, and suppressing authentic female characteristics denudes women of who they are and sets them up for failure. Women's attempt to accommodate the masculine model of authority encourages suspicion, derision, and cultural isolation from both men and women. As one male manager says, "One woman scares the pants of me. Very aggressive, very successful, very capable. I think for some women there's a belief that that's what it takes. Now the trouble is, if a man does it, it's like he's the tough one. If a woman does it, she's a hard bitch." Unequal power relationships in organisations spawn a range of dynamics. Women need to get on with men to get their support. The support of a key male player can make the difference between a woman failing or thriving at senior level. Women need to understand men and to collude with unspoken rules and codes of behaviour that shape the strategic relationship dynamic. Women's dependence on male advocacy renders them vulnerable. In order to retain men's favour, they tread a fine line to ensure that they are not perceived as a threat to the power of the senior male. A woman who oversteps the mark does so at her peril. And there's quotes galore in the report. Without effective understanding and management of these primitive interplays, women can find themselves the targets of male aggression or male idealisation. Initiatives to support women's progress into leadership roles has been orientated towards assisting women adapt their behaviours to culturally fit within a male-dominated environment, rather than changing the environment. They try to provide women with stilts to play on an uneven playing field. They don't flatten the field itself. Moreover, intervention in the main are not sufficiently integrated into core business and can be put on hold or discarded while organisational energy is devoted to core issues. This is short-sighted. If business wants to thrive in the longer term, then it needs to attract and retain female talent. Diversity must be a key strategic agenda item driven by senior leadership and incorporated into core business. The study makes a number of practical suggestions that address interventions at the level of changing the environment. Active leadership is required in naming the problem that has no name and showing vigilance in addressing unpalatable dynamics and cultures in all domains of organisational life. Business needs to unpack, for example, the meaning of cultural fit in their organisation and ensure it is not just another code word for propagating a culture of homogeneity. It needs to monitor meeting dynamics to ensure transparency in recruitment systems. It needs to audit remuneration packages to ascertain pay relativities between men and women. It needs to provide women with the opportunity to receive the mentoring that they need. It needs to explore structures and dynamics that see women in support roles and men in line roles. And it needs to ensure flexibility options are tailored to suit women's needs and more. A number of organisations in the study have introduced policies and procedures to begin addressing these barriers. A few have been successful. Most recognise that the task requires ongoing vigilance to ensure that well-meaning interventions are not thwarted. I wish them all the best in their endeavours. Thank you.